3 of the first edition or chapter 4 of every other later edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, the very first set of curves were done by Brown and Woodward. These guys spent roughly a man year in the laboratory measuring every possible kind of dipole you can think of, every possible length, every possible diameter. Unfortunately, the data you look at there is monopole data. In other words, if you had an infinite ground plane and you put up a quarter wave resonator, so to speak, to do the radiating, every dipole is a pair of monopole antennas back to back. So all of that data is completely usable for dipoles. Just that whatever you measure there in resistive component, whatever you measure there in reactive component, for their measured monopoles, you double up every one of those numbers and you know exactly what a dipole is going to do. For every possible diameter, every possible length of a dipole are in those Brown and Woodward curves. So no matter how you want to construct, let me drop. No matter how you want to construct your dipole, Brown and Woodward has a curve that will tell you exactly what reactive component and what resistive component of impedance you're going to experience. Now the next step is, I know Brown and Woodward directly didn't tell you what happens with that dipole above ground. There you go to the appropriate chapter of the AROL antenna book, and they've got a set of curves that will show you how the impedance changes as you change the dipole X number of wavelengths above ground. And it becomes kind of a spiral curve when you plot it on a kind of paper where the resistive component is horizontally displayed on the chart and the reactive component is vertically displayed. So you get a bunch of decreasing circles that zero in on 72 ohms as you make the antenna further and further above ground. So by way of the antenna handbook of AROL, you now know exactly what impedance your dipole is going to give you because of your altitude above ground. And you can make a decision. If you believe that the resistive component, that's the one you care about, would be better matched for your particular dipole, your particular altitude, with a 2-to-1 balance instead of 1-to-1 balance, go for it. But in almost all cases, if you are a serious amateur, you're either going to build or buy an antenna tuner. And once the antenna tuner is present, whether you choose a two to one, a 1-to-1, or a 4-to-1 balun, becomes a wash. The antenna tuner corrects whatever impedance is going to appear in the shack. And my guess is, Mel, that you, as a serious amateur on HF frequencies, I would guess that 98% of the time you use an antenna tuner when you're making contacts. You've got it available. It ends an awful lot of grief. It gives you exactly the right frequency of resonance. It gets rid of all of your harmonics. It does nothing but good things. It costs you nothing to use it.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
You've got that antenna tuner. You built it with tender loving care. It does such a beautiful job. I am guessing you use it 98% of the time. I am guessing your major recommendation for guys who have a no-tune transmitter that they can easily buy these days, and those old-fashioned rigs like the DX100 and the KWM1 and whatever, the rigs that really had tuning and loading controls are so rare nowadays that essentially everybody needs an antenna tuner. So I'm guessing you almost always use it and you would recommend it. But I'm putting words in your mouth. Go ahead and give us your opinion on this, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh yes, I'm a firm believer in the using the tuner. It does solve a lot of problems. All right, let's go back a little bit and clarify this. On, let's say, 160 meters or even 80 meters, or maybe down as much as 40 meters, I think you can skip the balun, just like you say, go directly with the coax. And why do I say that? Because I think, I mean, this is my thought, that the diameter of the coax in reference to the frequency is very small. I don't think you're going to have really the need for a balun. The experiment I'm looking right now that Jerry Civic did, he says, my experiment with the balun was conducted on 20 meters with a half-wave dipole at the height of 0.17 wavelength. I found that the resonant impedance with the installed balun was 50 ohms. Everything looked good, except when I noticed that when the cable dropped down at 45 degree angle under the dipole, a large change in the VSWR took place. He says, I accounted for this. This meant that the inverted L mode was unappreciably thick, sorry. K2RW, do you want to make a comment? Go ahead.
Yeah, you had a couple of dropouts. Maybe that switch gave you a little bit of grief. And I think you're running high power because I'm not hearing any hiss in the background. Whether you homebrew the Balun or buy the Balun, they're not very expensive, is a choice you can make. Whether or not you use one or don't use one is a choice you can make. It's not a showstopper. Dipoles work beautifully without one. The majority of us don't live in a tightly packed apartment building where we've got nearby residents with an analog television. The good news about digital television is that if you're giving your neighbor television interference, all he knows is that the picture disappears. He doesn't have the vaguest idea what's causing it. The identification now of the causer of television interference has become much more obscure now that we're on digital television. So I wouldn't worry so much. These are fine details. Get on the air. Buy yourself, in my opinion, a used transmitter. Try to buy one that has a recommended brand name and model number, that has a known good track record that your friends have recommended to you. If it's a 2-meter rig and you want all mode characteristics, my favorite, oldie but goodie, is a Kenwood TS711A. That's what you're listening to right now. It does everything I want, but it's not super compact. It's not made for mobile operation. It's a base station rig. But it's got a built-in 110-volt power supply. Doesn't need a separate 12-volt power supply. Nice and simple to use. Self-contained. The world's best frequency synthesizer and nice, clean sideband comes out of it. And if you're a serious 2-meter operator, someday you're going to want to try sideband. It's got some huge advantages. I wouldn't say over FM. When I eat a meal, I use a knife and a fork. When I'm on 2 meters, I use sideband and FM. They each have their advantages, their purposes. So buy a used rig.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Throw up a dipole with or without Balun and start talking to people. And then later add the refinements of a Balun and an antenna tuner and different kinds of antennas. Wire antennas are so inexpensive, you're not going to build just one. You're eventually going to fill up the backyard with 2, 3, 4 of them. Your neighbors, for the most part, do not see wire. You can string a zillion antennas up in the trees, and for the most part, the neighbors do not see them. I'll admit that you start putting great big Yaggies on top of the roof of the house, they're going to start seeing that. And maybe you want to go there if you've got adaptable neighbors and a good relationship with them. And if you're a serious 10-meter, 15-meter, 20-meter ham radio operator and you want to do some DX work, there's an awful lot to be said for a rotatable Yagi on the chimney of the house or on top of the tower. So try these various things, talk to the people who are doing them, and make some decisions as to what you want. And this is a hobby. You're doing it for fun. You have to make a decision what part of the hobby, which one of the 25 or 26 kinds of ham radio are going to give you the most amount of fun, the most amount of bang for the dollar. And you might very well try 2, 3, or 4 of them. I've done a tiny bit of moon bounce. I've done a tiny bit of satellite work. I've done some meteor scatter. I've done quite a bit of 10 gigahertz microwave work. And that's a lot of fun. 10 gigs, 432, 2 meters. These are some of my favorite bands. I've used very little HF, the frequencies below 30 megacycles. Mel has used a lot of frequencies below 30 megacycles. He gets a lot of pleasure out of DXing and talking to people in foreign countries and picking their brain and finding out what life is like under that particular regime. And there's a lot to be said for all of the above. There's lots and lots of ways of doing it. Over to you for some further comments on this, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
WS2N.
Paul recognized, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, as Dick says, there is some convenience in using the Balun, that it's gives you a nice point, usually on top with a hook set, to hang the antenna for a sense of support. It also gives you terminals that they have on them that are very convenient and places a way to act as a center insulator, strain relief, and usually a connector that makes it very convenient to hook the coax to. So it does have those things going for them. And I guess you won't go wrong with it if you decide you want to buy the Balam, the 1-to-1 or the 2-to-1 Balam. I don't think you'll see any really magnificent changes in either one of them and say, oh, wow, they'll both work. And as far as I'm concerned, if it's going to be 160, 80, or 40 meters, I go right with the coax right up to an insulator. If it's going to be one of those dipoles, and don't worry about it. That's personal opinion. But that's, I don't know. I guess there may be people out there that, you know, would not agree with me on that factor about those still maybe require something like that. Let me let it drop. And if you have an antenna tuner, it'll take care of all the little differential problems in the system, make the transceiver look well and fix it. Well, hook it up, get on the air, enjoy ham radio. That's the bottom line. So I can't think of anything else to say about this subject. And I guess no matter who you talk to, they'll have another opinion, which balance or which way to go. But I find that I'm using open wire feeders on 160 and 80 meters, and it seems to work out quite well with me. A lot of people would disagree with me with a open wire feeder. So, you know, it's a matter of choice. And in fact, as far as this week, we had a little picnic today at the club for the end of the summer, and I took a little portable rig, let me drop one more time. And I took my little portable 5-watt QRP transmitter down to the park right here in Manhattan Beach. I just set up a simple dipole on 20 meters, operating CW, and we made some contacts into Europe and all, and Russia. One of the guys had a nice QSO with a guy in Russia, and I did work a couple of other guys in Europe. And I've been running the QRP radio 5-watt. Good part of this week just to get used to using it. I haven't dug it out in quite a while since I got it working. It put to the side. And worked quite a bit of DX, and they were quite amazed. But DX just shows you that even with that power level, with a good antenna system, that it's practical to work DX. So do your best. That's it. I know, Dick said, we're not all privileged enough to be able to put up a tower of beams and all. But that is not a showstopper, as Dick said, that even any compromise antenna, whatever you can manage, do your best you can, you will definitely make contact. Be patient. Sometimes it takes a lot of calling before you do work somebody, but shows you it can be done even with QRP. Okay, back to you, Dick. This is KCY.
Hi, Neil. Your switch dropped out about 5 times, but very brief dropout, so we didn't miss any words. Paul, I wonder if you have a further question on this subject. You might well, and you might also have a space report. Either one, go right ahead, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Hey, I was just going to comment on, anybody that wants to put these, instead of a ballon up, something that looks like a ballon, just a... to serve the purpose, like what you said in the beginning, Dick, to have a support with eyes coming out of it. You really don't even have to, you could buy them, but you could make them. You can go down to the hardware store. I made one recently, and now I'm gonna make another one, a little different, a little easier, out of PVC. All you need is, the SO239 connector. You need 2-inch-and-a-quarter PVC caps, threaded caps. You could do this without the glue. And then all you need is a 3-inch threaded 1-inch-and-a-quarter nipple, also PVC. sometimes you get the white ones that would look nice. They have the gray color ones as well. What you do is you take the SO239 connector and you take the one cap. Sometimes you get the caps that are flat on the bottom. If you can't get them, sometimes they're rounded off. You could just sand one of the caps flush, and you could drill a hole the same size as the SO239 connector and a couple little holes for the screws. And you bolt that. You can bolt that into the cap. Before you do that, it would be easier to also solder to the SO239 connector. You know, you have two wires coming off the side and the center. And what you do is, you know, you might maybe use like number 14 wire that I use, which was good. And you could take two spade connectors, like the telephone. The telephone guys use those small, in fact, I think they're called telephone spade connectors. And they're like crimp on, but then you solder.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, you have the spade connectors connected to the little wires. And now on the side of the nipple, you just go a couple of small holes, you know, opposing one another, 180 degrees out, out from one another. And you screw in. At the same hardware store, Ace Hardware, I think it's very good. They have stainless steel eyes, screw eyes. They're not screw, threaded eyes. I think mine was 3/16. But you get these eyes, and you put one on one side, one on the other, and two nuts on the inside of each, and two nuts on the outside of each. And you tighten them up, and one nut on the inside. You take this little spade connector and you screw that to that, tighten that up. You do that to the same thing to the other side, and then you have that gives you your connections outside the little plastic connector. Now you can take the before you connect those connectors, you take Teflon tape on the bottom and you put it on the thread and you tighten the cap up on the bottom. Now you can connect your connectors on the inside. Now everything's really done. All you need is the cap on top. You can drill one hole through that if you want. If you're going to suspend it from somewhere, I didn't suspend mine, but if you want to suspend it from somewhere, you can drill a hole through the top of that cap and put some silicone on that to, you know, make it waterproof and tighten down on that little eye, the little stainless steel eye, and that gives you your hook to suspend from somewhere. You take that, put more Teflon tape on, you wrap that around three or four times, just like you did on the bottom. Let me drop it. And then you tighten this thing up. You don't have to kill it. You know, just a big pair of pliers or a wrench. You just tighten these things up, and they'll never leak, ever. And there you go. You have your own. You don't have to send away for it. Probably cost you, you know, maybe $5-$10, no more than that, and probably less than that. You know, I think each eye is like $2, so that's like $6, and nipple is a couple of, yeah, probably $10-$11 for everything. And you have a nice little thing to suspend it with. Connect your PL259 connector to the bottom, and you're in business. Pull the thing up into the trees or wherever you got to hang it from, Dick. Back to your WX2S.
Yes, it's obvious, Paul, that there's a lot of ways of mechanically homebrewing your own support and/or ballonning structure. And we forgot to mention that one very inexpensive way of making a poor man's ballon is just a few turns of the coax cable taped together or held together with tie wraps. The dipole itself, if you make direct contact between the center conductor and the shield to the two halves of your dipole, the dipole itself will try to force an electronic centering of the signals. As such, there will be some RF energy being fed down the outside of your coax cable because of its contact to the dipole, if you're not using a ballon. But you can easily create an RF choke to stop that RF energy from traveling all the way down the outside of the coax cable by wrapping three or four turns, maybe five turns, of the coax cable into a coil right at the dipole, and taping it or holding it together with various techniques. that RF choke will stop the majority of the signal from flowing down the outside of the cable, and will have almost no effect on the signal flowing down the inside of the cable that's going to the dipole. That's called the poor man's balun. Works very well. Lots of guys have done it. They've done it not only on dipoles. A number of the respected designs, let me drop. A number of the respected designs for the driven element of a Yagi antenna uses the poor man's balun. Sometimes the coil itself is suspended below the boom of the Yagi so that the plane of the coil is perpendicular to the elements, but parallel to the boom itself. That way the coil has no electronic coupling to the signal being radiated by the element of the dipole. So, as I said, a number of respected Yagi designs have the poor man's balun on it. Very effective structure. Okay, the next thing I think we want to discuss is what's going on in Hempstead and also in South Hold and a number of other communities on Long Island. Let me drop. Tuesday of this week, Hempstead Town had a 5-1 or a 7-1 vote, 5-0 or 7-0, whatever it was. Every one of the town supervisors were in favor of this brand new ordinance with reference to cell sites. Supervisor Kate Murray said the new ordinance was proposed last month, and she gave a couple of words about the fact that now all of these cell sites are really going to have to toe the mark before they get permission to set up a brand new cell site in Hempstead Town. And I believe she's sincere, and she thinks she's responding to what the residents want. However, a year, 2-3 years from now, it is my belief that all of this action of Hempstead Town is going to be a whole lot of sound and fury that results in nothing beneficial of any kind. It looks on paper like it's beneficial. It will not be beneficial. The new rules are such that in order to make an application for a new cell site in Hempstead Town, you must propose a site in which you first prove the need. On paper, that sounds great. It's absolutely crazy. Let me show you why. In order for a cell phone company to put up a cell site, they're going to invest between $250,000 per site just to establish the installation. A cell phone company is a profit-making organization. They don't throw away $500,000 at a time. If they're willing to invest $500,000 to set up a cell site, they are serious. They really have a need, or they wouldn't be doing it. They wouldn't be throwing money down a rat hole. To ask them to prove it is crazy. It assumes that they are just willy-nilly setting up cell sites, no way in hell. And they assume that all of the mathematics that are used to prove that the coverage improvement will take place and that there are dropout zones, in order to understand all of that mathematics, the town people don't understand that. They're going to have to hire another expert to interpret the results that they're asking for. And they're also asking for the outside expert that's hired by the town must be paid for by the cell site. The bottom line is they're increasing the cost of the installation. No other benefit is taking place. They also are restricting that every new cell site must have a sign on it describing the radiation hazard. That's crazy. There is no radiation hazard. Because the cell site itself is on a 100-foot tower, the antenna is aimed at the horizon, in order for you to be exposed to amount of RF energy that crosses the threshold of alarm, you'd have to be on a 100-foot high hook and ladder, standing about 3 feet in front of the antenna at the 100-foot altitude, and stay there for a minimum of 6 minutes when every one of the transmitters is turned on full blast. Is that a radiation hazard? Down at base level, you have to put a sign across it indicating how much biohazard there is? Come on. That's crazy.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The FCC has made it clear in the Communication Act of 1996 or 1995, whichever it is, saying that you cannot deny the siting of a cell site based on a perceived risk of radio frequency biohazard. The United States alone has been studying that for 60 years. All the other major countries in the world have been studying it for almost the same length of time. There is no biohazard from a cell site. the cell site itself radiates approximately 30 watts of power on average. The 60 years of research proves that when RF energy strikes a human being, 99% of the effect is purely thermal. The RF energy, the portion of it that does get absorbed, which is a function of frequency and angles and whatever, of the portion that absorbed, the only thing that happens is it becomes heating. You are protecting people from the heat of a 30-watt light bulb. That's what the radiation of a cell site antenna is. It's equal to a 30-watt light bulb of thermal energy hitting your body. The next restriction they've got is that every new cell site must be 1,500 feet away from every residence, every house of worship, every school, and every daycare center. You use all of those restrictions of 1,500 feet, 98% of all of Hempstead is illegal. All of the cell sites that are there right now are not going to be discussed. This is only the new ones. Where in the world did the 1,500-foot number come from? If you really want to protect the people from the 30-watt light bulb that is the cell site signal being radiated, the answer should be 1.5 feet, not 1,500 feet. It's well known that the amount of signal that gets into your body from the thing you hold in your hand, the cell phone itself, because it's only a quarter of an inch or half inch away from your head. Let me drop. The cell phone itself, the energy that gets into your body, is 1 million times stronger than the amount of radiation you would get from the cell site if your house was directly next door, as close as you can possibly get. That great big, let me pick a number, 20,000 pounds of hardware, 100 feet high, with all of those antennas sitting on top of it, that ominous-looking structure, because of the extra distance between you and it, is giving you an amount of radio signal into your body that is 1 million times weaker than when you've got the cell phone against your head and you're talking. I didn't say the cell phone against your head is dangerous. All I'm saying is that no matter what the danger of the cell phone is, the cell site, the thing that you see that is so ominous, is 1 million times lower because of the extra distance. And to require that to have a radiation sign on it is crazy. As I said, this is all going to be because of the rules of the FCC saying you cannot deny because of a perceived risk of radio frequency biohazard. There is none. When you lay on the beach in the summertime, the solar radiation that the sun gives you is roughly 1,000 watts. The cell site is a 30-watt light bulb. And we're afraid of a 30-watt light bulb, but we don't talk about the sun. The body easily handles the 1,000 watts of energy that comes in when you lay on the beach and the sun is shining on you because the wind is blowing and evaporation is taking place. Your body is designed to take 1,000 watts of energy. Of thermal energy. That's what the sun gives you. Yes, if you're not properly prepared and if it's high noon and you don't have the right solar protection cream on, you could get some sunburn because of the ultraviolet content.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The higher frequency rays from the sun, the ultraviolet, yes, that can give you some sunburn, and that you've got to be careful of. Everything below that in frequency is purely thermal. That's where the majority of the energy is, and the body can handle that. How come no one has realized that a cell site is a thermal source of energy equal to approximately a 30-watt light bulb? All of this crazy sets of rules and expense and applications and delays and everything else is to protect the public from a 30-watt light bulb that is an ominous-looking structure that they can see. Now, you can make the structure more pretty by making it look like a tree. But the people who know what a tree looks like have got a name for those things. They call them frankenpines. It's not a pine tree. I'm a little bit disappointed that the cell site manufacturers that make some of them look like a tree didn't go the next step of hiring somebody who knows what a tree looks like. With 10% more effort, they could make something that looks like a tree. Of all the Christians in the United States, a high percentage of them at Christmas time have a tree in the house. A high percentage of those trees are now artificial. And the artificial tree looks very good if you buy the right brand name. we know how to make a good-looking artificial tree. How come we can't do that with a cell site? That's crazy. So that's the one place where the cell companies have fallen down a little bit. They didn't make the trees look like a tree. They threw a couple of branches on it and say, hey, it's a tree. It's now aesthetically pleasing. If a cell site is being denied because it's not aesthetically pleasing for the particular location in town, I can sort of understand that. And to claim, though, that it's creating a health hazard and that it's lowering property values. Good sounding on paper, not in reality. There is no evidence that it lowers the property values. And by the way, when it comes to the biohazard of cell sites, the more of them, the safer. The cell site in your hand is a power-managed system.
If repeater, timeout, cancel.
If an inner cell site is half a mile away, the thing in your hand runs a couple of milliwatts of transmit power. That's all it needs to do. If the nearest cell site is 6 miles away from you, the thing in your hand has to go to maximum power, probably close to a watt. The amount of RF energy that goes into your body is inversely proportional to the number of cell sites that are in the town. You add more cell sites, the people get safer. The thing that gives them the maximum signal by a million-to-one ratio into their body is the thing they hold on to. You restrict the number of cell sites in the town, you get dropout of coil, you get dropouts of calls, you get unhappy people, and you get batteries that go dead sooner, you get a thing in your hand that runs hotter, and more RF energy goes into your body. To allow more cell sites makes all of that go in the other desirable direction. How come the people in the town don't realize that? How come they got it so backwards? It's because of a misunderstanding of RF radiation. That damn word is causing all of this grief. The word radiation. Just like the N-word should be restricted from our vocabulary, when it comes to radio, the word radiation should be restricted from our laboratory, from our vocabulary. It is radio signaling, it's radio communication, it's radio contacting, it's sending information. Call it any of the combinations of words. It is not a source of radiation by the usual use of the word when you're talking about nuclear radiation. Everybody thinks there's a relationship between the two. There isn't. There's 60 years of research in the United States alone and a hell of a lot of similar research in a whole lot of countries. That American National Standard Institute report, which is the main defining document, the C95 document for the United States, represents 60 years of continuous research by our best laboratories, our best institutions, our best...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Our best universities, it contains 450 references. It's used as the defining document for the Department of Department of Defense, for the all of the armed services, for NIOSH, OSHA, and whatever. It is the defining document for this nation on the effects of RF energy on human beings. London has a similar one called, made by the Radio Frequency Protection Board and so on. And Germany has a similar one, and Japan has a similar one, Australia has a similar one. And they all, if you read each one of them, they all say essentially the same thing. In Europe, which we think of as a much more conservative country than us, they allow 2 watts per kilogram of specific absorption rate. The amount of RF energy that comes out of the cell phone that enters your body and gets absorbed is called SAR, specific absorption rate. The units there are in watts per kilogram. We allow 1.6 watts per kilogram. Europe allows 2.0. watts per kilogram. We're safer than them. And that's very well documented. You can talk about the milliwatts per square centimeter. That's the amount of signal that comes directly before it gets absorbed. That's some number of milliwatts per square centimeter hits the body, and now how much gets absorbed in watts per kilogram. The solar energy in watts per kilogram is a huge number, bigger than what we're talking about here with radio. It's a strong misunderstanding. So, to restrict, to put on all of these crazy restrictions, as I said, is a great big delay tactic. The people who are informed are essentially going to be laughing at the towns that do this because they're creating a great big delay, and the bottom line effect is going to have the exact opposite of what they think. There's not going to be allowed any more cell sites because 1,500 feet. Where in the world did that number come from? If you're doing it for aesthetics, that's more than a quarter of a...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
a 1,500-foot restriction from every resident, house of worship, school, and daycare center. A quarter of a mile means that it's way beyond visual. You can't even see the darn thing. If we're doing that for aesthetics, how in the world, aesthetically, do we tolerate telephone poles, utility poles? We've got one of them down every single street, every 150 feet. It's the most dangerous thing in the world. Of all the people who die in automobile accidents on Long Island, a significant percentage of them die because their automobile strikes that very solid thing called telephone pole, utility pole. We don't see those because they've been around a long time. Our mind has become blinded to them. But they serve a very good purpose, and we're going to, they give us a good risk-to-benefit ratio, and we're willing to tolerate them. But there are people who will come from Europe and look at our towns and say, how in the world do you tolerate all those things? And the answer is we don't see them. We see these cell sites because they're brand new things. Should they be hidden behind shrubs and hidden in cupolas of church buildings and hidden behind phony facades and made inside of phony trees? I can understand that. That makes some sense. If you think the aesthetics of your town is that important, there is a zillion ways of hiding the darn thing without disturbing its performance. But to put all these restrictions on it that stop the original intent. The original intent of the cell phone base station is to create reliable communication. And that reliable communication saves a ridiculous number of lives. Although we use it and misuse it in a whole lot of ways, like texting while we're driving or whatever, still, when you're in an accident and somebody makes a call on a cell phone and calls emergency services, within approximately 60 seconds, that emergency service is rolling toward your aid, and there's a good chance that life and death depends on the amount of time it takes to get them there.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If you succeeded in using all of these restricted rules to apply to all the cell sites at the original time of application, which means you'd have a very small percentage of the number of cell sites you've got now, a hell of a lot more people would die in automobile accidents because emergency services couldn't be called soon enough. So we've got it backwards. You guys are the radio savvy people. Some of you guys have friends that live in Bayville, Hicksville, Hempstead, South Hold, East Hampton, Bethpage. Each of these towns think that radio is bad. When it comes to using the cell site, when it comes to using the cell phone, it's good. But the hardware that supports that is bad. They've got this erroneous opinion that it's bad, and they've got to do everything they can to restrict it. They've got it backwards. They're protecting us from a 30-watt light bulb. That is crazy. How come they don't see that? You guys must have a lot of opinions about this. Give me your call letters right now. I'm a little hot under the collar. K2RAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB.
John recognized. Anyone else?
KQ2O.
KQ2O recognized with no name. Anyone else?
WA2EGT, Charlie.
Echo Golf Tango, Charlie. Anyone else?
A2J.
And Eric. Okay, let's start off with John. You got it, John.
Thank you, Dick. Okay, they want a sign. I have no problem with that. Give them a sign. On the sign, it should have the SAR rate, its equivalence. Nobody's going to understand it. All right, you want to talk to people and try to convince them the proper ways, the truth about the system? I agree with that 100%. That may have an effect. But if you extrapolate it further, Dick, if I understand what you said, the gentleman or lady next to me in the restaurant transmitting on her cell phone is exposing me to a high rate, also probably higher than the cell site she's talking to. Should she have a sign on her? And the last question, a warning sign that is, the last question is, has anybody actually done simple Petri dish experiments with living tissue and DNA examinations and the effect of radiation? Again, I'm using the word, the way it really is used, of the RF radiation. Has anybody proven any of this? Those are my questions and comments. Thank you.
I'll take some of those in reverse order, John. That experiment of the Petri dish probably has been done 500 times. I personally talked to Dr. John W.C. Fox, Downstate Medical Center, 1980, roughly, in which he and his co-researchers at Downstate Medical Center were taking the most sensitive cells they could find. These were cells undergoing mitosis in a Petri dish. I think they were skin cells, but I'm not sure. And they were putting an X-band, a microwave transmitter, a horn antenna with a negative impedance diode transmitter type thing alongside of it, measuring the amount of power flux density in milliwatts per square centimeter. I think they went as high as either 5 or 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. Exposed various Petri dishes for weeks on end with controls. In other words, some of the dishes had the dish right alongside of the feed horn, but the feed horn wasn't turned on, and others had the feed horn turned on. And they compared the results after a couple of weeks. There was no difference. The only experiment I know of with radiation on human beings that seemed to show an effect is that a person who is using a cell phone against his head that's running in the high power mode, roughly 1 watt, and you ask him to do mental mathematics of calculating mathematics mentally. The guy with the cell phone against his head, where his brain is running a fraction of a degree warmer because of the thermal effect, is able to calculate the numbers a little bit faster than the person without the cell phone. The person with the cell phone that's not turned on. And again, that's another double-blind test. So when it comes to the experiments on biological equipment...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
On biological substances, you read all those 400... You read the appropriate number of the 450 references that are in the American National Standard Institute report, and you will see quite a few of those experiments. And where there was a slight difference, it could all be explained thermally. Now, when you and I touch high voltage and we get what you and I call an electrical shock, you would assume that there's a direct electrical contact effect in human beings. It turns out your nerves operate by a primarily chemical reaction. And yes, you put a high enough voltage on your hands, you disturb that chemistry in such a way the nerves do create a phony signal that creates muscle contractions and whatever. You are led to believe that there is a direct electrical effect of a radio signal on a human being. Not really. Thermally, yes. Electrically, no. The fact that you can get an electrical shock would lead you to believe that. You'd like to believe now that the next step after that is radio signal hits a human being, gets rectified, and becomes a phony signal that goes down the nerves and starts creating a phony signals in the brain. It doesn't work that way. They've been looking for 60 solid years for anything but the thermal effect. For all practical purposes, they have found none. There appears to be none. And in order to get the accepted threshold of alarm right now in the United States, which is approximately 1 milliwatt per square centimeter, you'd have to be standing 1.5 feet in front of that cell phone base station antenna while it's transmitting and stay there for 6 solid minutes. You would then be at the threshold of alarm for the current American standard and most of the European standards. So if you're going to protect people from coming within 1.5 feet of the antennas of the cell site, I'm all for it. 1,500 feet. Where in the world?
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
1,500 feet. Where in the world did that number come from? It's a rabbit hat trick. It's way beyond visual sighting. But it makes essentially all of Hempstead illegal for cell sites, except for the swampy areas and one or two commercial areas. And that's going to give you extremely poor coverage if you carry that out. They can't carry that out. Temporarily they can. There's going to be a bunch of lawsuits where the FCC and the federal law cancels that particular zoning ordinance. It's not going to stay there. It's not going to stay on the books. It's just going to create a whole lot of cash flow, gnashing of nerves, and unhappy people temporarily, and dropped calls. To force a cell site to prove that they have a need when the real cost of establishing one is so darn high that they wouldn't be doing it if there wasn't a need. To force the town to believe it is crazy. To force the town to hire a consultant to confirm it, and then you have to pay the consultant up to $1,700 or $17,000. That's crazy. That's the way the current law is written in Hempstead Town. That's what got approved on Tuesday. There was another point you made, John, that I forgot. Back to you for one more. What did I forget to mention, John? Oh, yes. Next door. When you're at a restaurant and the person next to you is using a cell phone, you are now, what, a foot or two away from their cell phone, and their head is about a half inch away from it. They're getting, I'll pick a number out here, 50 times more RF energy than you are. The amount of energy that enters that person's head who is using the cell phone, let me drop. The cell phone itself would not have gotten approval to be manufactured and sold in the United States if the manufacturer did not prove that the specific absorption rate with normal use of the phone was not lower than 1.6 watts per kilogram. So, in other words, the phone has already been proven to be safe when it's directly against your head. When you're 3, 4, or 5 feet away from it, and you know, you and I can easily calculate the inverse square law of half an inch versus 3, 4, or 5 feet, that's going to be a number that's very big. It's probably 500 to 1. You're getting an amount of RF energy in your body. And it's probably 500 times lower than the person that's using the cell phone. The person using the cell phone, by all measurements we can make, is safe. You're getting 1/500th of that are safe. And if the cell site is directly across the street from where you're sitting at that luncheon counter, the person using the cell phone is getting 1 million times more because of the cell phone compared to what they're getting to that great big chunk of hardware directly across the street from that restaurant. The piece of hardware that is the cell site looks formidable to an uninformed person. But it's safe as all hell if you understand the physics involved. Thank you for any comment on that one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Dick, I agree with you 100%. Just the fact that the company puts out an effort and there's a demographic study done before they open anything, even a Burger King, that piece of paper should be proof enough to prove the need. And I agree with you, they're not going to invest the money without it. But thank you, you've covered all my questions. On to the next. Thank you.
Well, one of the next things you've got to worry about with the Hempstead Ordinance is that they are now trying their best to force all cell sites to reuse the exact same sites. If I'm T-Mobile and there's already a Verizon site, they're forcing me to use the exact same pole, and now we're combining T-Mobile with Verizon, for instance. On paper, it sounds good. Bad thing to do. Yes, with real good filtering and real good high-performance spectral purity of all your frequency synthesizers, of all the oscillators, of all of those transmitters, in theory, the different services on adjacent frequencies, in theory, don't interfere with each other. Beautiful-sounding thing on paper. That ain't the reality. You take anybody else's cell site, cell equipment, and you force it to go on my tower with my electronics. Both companies are going to suffer an amount of desensitization. The only thing left to discuss is how much. Whatever service was there will be degraded. That's the physics. You put somebody else's transmitter a couple of megacycles away from a very sensitive receiving antenna, and the two antennas are only a few feet apart. As far as that receiver is concerned, there's a tremendous amount of transmitter signal of that other surface entering that antenna. And unless you've got the world's best shielding and the world's best filtering, which is great when the equipment is brand new, but after it's been serviced a few times by a few tower riggers, and some of these tower riggers in some cases use a Stilson wrench to tighten a type N connector. They don't worry about cross-threading it and putting dirt inside and whatever. You go a year or two or three downrange where you've now forced two, three, and...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You go a year or two downrange where you've now forced two, three, or four services on the exact same structure. Not only does the structure look a lot more crowded and a little bit more ugly, but all of those services suffer. I'll admit the amount of suffering with very good engineering and very good maintenance is somewhat tolerable. But there is a measurable amount of desensitization and degradation of service when you force that. Whereas if you allow the cell sites to be, let me pick a number, 1,000 feet apart from each other, now the amount of signal from brand A that gets into brand B's receiving equipment is drastically decreased. Again, the inverse square law works tremendously in your favor. I know of cell site companies right now that are being interfered with where the second harmonic of one service falls into the primary frequency of another service, and even with the cell sites 1,000 feet apart, the signal, the second harmonic of one going into the other, is creating tremendous amounts of desensitization. That's being measured today, right now, with 1,000-foot separation. You force those two services on the exact same tower, I don't have to tell you what's going to happen. Again, it's crazy. It's a thorough misunderstanding. The total performance of the system goes down when you put on these ridiculous restrictions, which on paper sound good. In reality, they're backwards. KQ2O, I think your name is John. Go right ahead, John. What would you like to tell us? KQRIW in the TechNet.
I just wanted to let you know that I'm just listening and enjoying the conversation, and you can go ahead. KQ2O, listening.
KC2OOA.
KC2OOA, added to the list. The next person on the list is WA2 Echo Golf Tango. Charles, I think it is. I can't read my own writing. Echo Golf Tango, you know who you are. Go right ahead.
K2RIW on the net. This is WA2EGT. Good evening, Dick, and good evening to everybody on the net. Dick, regarding, once again, language, and I am the guy who had the, we had the variometer discussion a few weeks ago, and this is another language question. In my mind, we should try to replace the word radiation with emission. We speak of radiation angles from an antenna, substitute emission angle, or the word emitting. Unfortunately, it's not going to happen. Because this word radiation is so entrenched in our language, I don't think it's going to change. We hear on the net, we use that word over and over again, and I don't see that changing. And it does have very bad connotations with the public. Another aspect of this discussion, another aspect is, well, this is of a personal nature. I have a timer here. I'm just going to drop you for a second. Okay, my personal situation is I share a house with my brother, and I have very difficult time putting up any kind of antennas because he is completely paranoid about RF fields, even though he's a frequent user of cell phones. When I told him that, asked him whether or not he realized that when the cell phone receives a weak signal, it kicks up the transmitter power in the cell phone to maintain the link. He had no idea, and I have no doubt that the general public is clueless to that fact, and it is a crucial fact. And third item, while you were speaking on the subject, I went online and I was reading in the Long Island Press online, and it's really amazing what I'm reading here. I'm going to drop one more time here. I don't know as far as copyright laws are concerned, that I can read something verbatim here, so I'll try to paraphrase. And there's an attorney for the quote Merrick Moms, which is a community group that's opposing cell phone towers. And I'm sure you've seen this before, Dick, but I just find this amazing. He said that in Bayville there were five children who were attending a school 50 feet from cell phone antennas on a water tower, and they were diagnosed with cancer or leukemia, and that three have died. Now, here's a quote from him, and this floors me. He says, I am not prepared to produce experts that there is a direct correlation, but it's frightening. This, to me, reflects a trend in our society lately, that our society has become hostile towards science. We are one of the most scientifically advanced cultures in history, and yet we have this fear and misunderstanding of science. And frankly, I don't know what the answer is to this, Dick. And my compliments to you for presenting the argument so well, far better than I ever could. Especially since I have, especially since my heart starts pounding once I pick up this microphone. Back to you, Dick. This is Charlie WA2EGT.
Charlie,
K-2-Y-O.
When you recognize when you pick up the microphone, your heart starts pounding. I'm not quite sure why that takes place. What do you mean by that, Charlie? Go ahead.
Dick, I'm not sure myself. I had problems speaking in front of groups. I know there's a large group that listens to the TechNet. That makes me nervous. And throughout my ham radio career, I have not used voice. I use CW. There's no nervousness when I use CW, probably why I became proficient with it. Back to you.
Now I understand. Perfectly understandable. So, because of the public speaking aspect of talking to a large crowd and wanting to present yourself well, that creates nervousness, and that's an extreme case of normalcy as I see it, Charles. I thought at first you were saying that your heart starts pounding because of some kind of a effect of the radio transmitter itself, and thank goodness you were not saying that. Before I pass it over to Eric, who's the next person analyst, let me show you something else that's going on here. This was now the Friday, September 24th issue of Newsday, and they went down individual towns. Babylon has a restriction where the maximum height of any cell site cannot exceed 80 feet. Craziness. In East Hampton, the cell site cannot exceed the height of any nearby building within the nearest 300 feet. By restricting the height of the cell sites, you're restricting the range at which they can operate, and therefore you're forcing more of them to be required. They've got it backwards. Islip does not allow cell phone companies seeking to place a tower in a park or within 500 feet of a residential zone. Now that's a little bit more reasonable compared to the Hempstead, 1,500 feet. My goodness. East Hampton has a height, can't exceed the height of any building within 300 feet, and so on. All of these towns are coming up with crazy rules. I mean, what's going to happen is that ultimately almost every one of these rules are going to be struck down by a federal court, and therefore the major officer of the town that was behind the effort of coming up with these rules will say, okay, you can re-elect me into office. I did what you, the town residents, asked me to do. But my hands are tied. The federal government overruled me. But that's what's going to happen in an awful lot of these cases. It's a tremendous waste of effort as I see it. Eric, KE2EJ.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Go ahead, Eric. K2RIW.
Hi, Dick. KK2EJ. I gotta say something. Are you a member of the National Telecommunication Association? Are you a bona fide lobbyist? Because it sounds like, really, I mean, what you're saying is absolutely true, every word of it. Okay, but the presentation that you're giving sounds like you work for these guys, okay? So that's one thing, I mean, you know. And I know that when we have a passion about something, we really can get passionate about it. But you're talking to a broader audience here. And there's a couple of things that you're wrong about. The reason the cell phone companies put up cell towers is to make money. It's just to make money. If it weren't for the government saying, you must service 911 calls. You must also service 911 calls from phones that have been deactivated. If they had their choice, they would not. But, okay. So let's get past the emotional part of it, and let's get down to the science. All of the science that you mentioned is absolutely true. There's been hundreds of studies. And I've taken several courses on SAR because I work at these very high-powered transmitter sites. And, you know, there are areas on top of